thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. If you've been waiting on the one military aviation podcast that covers it all, well, you found it. Because on this episode of the Fighter Pilot Podcast, two retired naval aviators with over 60 years of combined service and thousands of flight hours between them join us to discuss the legendary F-4 Phantom II.
What the design resulted in was not only a fighter that could do the air-to-air mission, but they could also carry bombs.
Aerial combat in Vietnam.
We did barrel roll, got behind the other MiG, and shot him off Rookie and Ken's tail. And that was our second kill of the day.
Prisoners of war.
And so I reached down with my good hand, ejected us both from the airplane. Next thing I knew, I'm hanging in a chute, coming down. Landed in a rice paddy. They came along, dragged me up, and stripped me down of all my gear. They took me down to the main road, threw me in the back of the truck, and took me to Hanoi.
And best of all, reconciliation among former adversaries.
Out of the six pilots, two of them were still alive, and I got to meet one of them. And we sat down at the table, and 43 years later, and we're remembering it the same way.
Be good. We got some trouble. Come on, back around. 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 Come on, back around.
Welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Now, here are your hosts, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilots Vincent Aiello and Brian Sinclair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 52 of the Fighter Pilot Podcast. I'm Jello. Joining me is Sunshine. What's up, dude?
Hey, Jello, not much. How are you these days?
I'm pretty good, thanks. We have an exciting episode coming up on the F-4 Phantom II. You had a chance to listen, although you weren't able to make it for the interview.
No, sadly wasn't, but a pretty epic discussion you guys, the three of you had there, and just all sorts of facts. Pretty amazing.
Yep. Well, we will get to that as we normally do here in a little bit. In the meantime, what's new in your world?
Well, just doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. My girls are still out of school, so enjoying that. We got family in town. How about you?
Oh, yes, it is summertime. My boys are out as well. Well, as a matter of fact, today I'm up in Los Angeles in my deceased father's home. Helping my sister do some transition type stuff. And we're preparing for his memorial on August 2nd. It's a Friday. He'll be laid to rest at the L.A. National Cemetery just off the 405 freeway next to UCLA, where he's an alum, as was I. And he was from L.A., and he'll be buried with his fellow military members. So we think that's a fitting tribute to the end of a very long and full life.
Absolutely. Is it kind of nostalgic going through some stuff up there in his house?
Oh, it's both nostalgic and funny. You find letters that he wrote to different people, and you see little tidbits that remind you of certain things. It's pretty interesting. But, you know, those who have not put some thought into end-of-life planning, you know, we all hear you got to do that. And, boy, my sister and I can tell you, you certainly do, because even with a living trust like he had, there's a lot to it. You know, there's silly rules like even the California DMV won't let you change the registration of his car for 40 days after you send them a death certificate. So it's just crazy stuff. But yeah, you know, it's just part of the way things go when you lose a loved one. But we're plodding through it.
How'd they come up with 40 days? Is that based on the great floods from way back when?
This is California, Sunshine. I'm not thinking that's the case. But I don't know.
We digress.
Yeah, they probably took what they thought was reasonable, which is 10 days, and said, okay, if 10 is good, 40 is better.
Boom. Hooray, anyway, California.
That's right. Well, dude, you and I have had a busy couple weeks. Let's see. What did we do? We had a live listener question and answer segment with episode 50, Hero Turkey, and we did that at your house.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Good. It was good to have Turkey back, and a lot of good questions, I thought. A lot of good answers, let me say. So just a good time. What a great American, isn't he?
Oh, he's good. Yes, for sure. Now, some people have been calling us out, Sunshine, on our lack of studio quality facilities. So I know we've got some work going on for your deep dive stuff with the green screens and the lights.
Yes.
Didn't you, you ended up getting some lapel mics, I think, right?
I did. And then I found a way, I think, to hook a DSLR into make it a webcam. So we'll see if that provides some better resolution. Yeah. So let's just say things are in work.
Well, and I like to think that the listeners forgive us because, in this case, the viewers, because it's the quality of the content, not necessarily the beauty of the hosts in this case.
Medium.
Myself, at least, I've heard that you're good looking. Anyway.
Well, not when it comes to HD. I don't think I am.
So, listeners, viewers, bear with us. One day we will have a BVR production studio and provide you Hollywood quality content. So anyway, let's see. What else did we do? We had an amusing post from a guest who reflected on being married to a fighter pilot. That's right. Thank you.
That was a good
read.
And
then you and I released another behind the scenes and remind the viewers what that one was about.
Yeah, so basically looking at final checkers. So it's a helmet cam of one of the troopers up there on the flight deck and steps through final checks. And I think, did we have a misspeak or two, Jello, on that?
You know, we do almost every behind the scenes. And the wonderful thing about our viewers is they don't hold back. They'll let us know. So one of the things I was schooled on is that the troubleshooters will be in white, but a final checker could be anyone. And so the young lady who was the counterpart in that video was a maintenance person who had the final checker qual, but was not a troubleshooter. So that we were reminded of that. This is stuff we knew once, Sunshine, and have forgotten in retirement. And then the other thing is the T on the helmet isn't for troubleshooter. That's for AT. So that young lady was an avionics technician. And then, of course, if it was an E, it'd be an avionics electrician. An O would be ordnance. Oh, gosh, what else is there? There's power plants and airframes and all kinds
of AD. Yeah, all sorts of goodness. So, okay.
But, you know, I've said ingest in different places before. I think I've learned more since retiring on certain things than I did when I was 25 years in, because you got so many listeners out there and viewers who know what they're talking about, and they don't hold back. They'll let us know when we're wrong, and we don't mind. At least I don't.
No, I appreciate the corrections. I kind of call it backup, if you will. So
and
even the listener questions. So the weekly, let's see, the Friday Tech Talk, if you will, the next picture that comes out is going to be based on a listener question that we got recently. So it should be pretty good.
Oh, excellent. Well, speaking of that, we got almost all the way caught up with our written questions with Turkey. That was wonderful. I think we're down to about a page and a half. But we do have some phone calls that we need to answer. So, Sunshine, what do you say we cover some of those today? But before you answer that, realizing you listened to me and Fingers and Tiger ramble on and on, that was a long interview.
Long, but you know, it kind of flew though, Jello. It was long, you're right, but I never found myself looking at my watch.
Ah, very
good. So that
was
real good, yeah.
Well, in the interest of, I don't know, I'm not sure what it is in the interest of, but I think as we produce all this, we will end up splitting it into two, and we'll separate it by a few days or a week or something.
Yeah.
And that just, it makes it tenable. I've heard from people that sit in their car when they get to work at the end of their commute, who, if the episode's not over, they get yelled at because they're late. So we don't want to be the cause for anyone losing their jobs.
I hear you. Yeah, good call. So now when it comes to these, so the dial-in questions, if you will, do you want to knock out about four of them today?
Sure. Why don't we? Let's play this first one. And I think it's from a local.
Okay.
Hi, Jello. My name is Max Hagman. I'm from San Diego, California. And I recently got a scholarship for the Air Force ROTC program here at San Diego State. I've been listening to your podcast for a while. I think it's really motivating to hear some of the great stories that you have, and so does Sunshine. And I was wondering, any advice for ROTC cadets going in, how to get the best experience in the ROTC program and to better yourself and become a better officer in the future? Thanks. Love your podcast. Bye.
All right. Great question, Matt. Mm-hmm, thank you for calling in. And he's local, so we need to probably get in touch with him. So I have a lot bouncing through my head, and I'll try to keep this as brief as I can. Because one thing here, Sunshine, is you and I and the rest of the team have talked about creating a forum or a community for young people like Matt who are making their way into training programs. And at some point, if they make their way through and they stick with us, they could help out the generation coming behind them. So we're looking to start serving this category a little bit better. It could be a closed Facebook group.
Okay.
It could be a forum on our website. It could be a Google group. We haven't decided yet. So that's one thing. The second thing is, you know, times have changed since I went through ROTC. It's been, I graduated in 1992, so I'm assuming
Jeez,
that probably
dude,
wasn't
you're old.
Even alive yet. Yeah, thank you. But I'm guessing my advice would still stand, and it's probably not that different than your advice, Sunshine, even though you didn't do ROTC. But I would say that you apply yourself to whatever you're doing, learn as much as you can, be as helpful as you can to those who are doing it and those around you, get as much from it as you can, internalize the lessons, wear a smile on your face, and move on to the next thing, and just try to always do your best. I mean, gosh, I wish I could tell a 30-year younger Jello this advice, because I know I certainly didn't do it, but with the experience now of, or the benefit of experience, I should say, I feel like that's really all there is to it, and I wish I could go back, but I don't know. Is that, what do you think there, Sunshine?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Now, I obviously didn't get a chance to do ROTC. I went through that small trade school over by the Severn River, but I would say practicing time management, because it's it's somewhat inconsequential in a college, I would say. It's consequential, but it's not as much as in the fleet. And also, I would try to learn how to accept criticism.
Ah.
You know, don't take it personally, it's all business, and keep it at that. And I think that'll also help you out in the aviation community, wouldn't you say, Jello?
Oh, absolutely. You have to be able to be told that you suck and to wear a poker face, but also to internalize that, to use that word again, to say that, you know what, he's right. I did not do that maneuver or whatever it was well, and I need to go do it better. And so what do I need to do to do that? The other thing I would add, and I tell anyone who reaches out with this kind of question, is don't forget to lead a balanced life. And that is, make sure you save time for exercising, because that's important. But also, go have fun. I mean, if you like to golf, go golfing. If you like to fly fish, go fly fishing. If you like helping or volunteering or family's important, do those things, because it'll make you so much more effective, all of those, exercise included, when you are working towards your goal. And so I think balance is important also.
Totally agree, man. Well put. All right, should we roll on to our next one?
You betcha.
Hi, I'm Griffin 13 from Arizona, and I was wondering if you guys will ever do an episode about the F-35 or the F-22 Raptor or the B-17 bomber, because my great-grandfather flew the B-17 in World War II, and I would like you to tell the story of him, his story about, and his story is he was flying over Germany in World War II and crashed in Germany and hiked all the way to Switzerland on foot. Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right, Griffin, thanks for calling in. Appreciate it from the good old, it's probably hot there in your desert this time of year. But thank you very much for the suggestions. Yeah, we've been working on an F-35 and F-22 pilots, and I did go to the Air Force test pilot school, so I got some buddies that flew those. So hopefully sooner than later, I'll get to catch up with, I'll just use call signs here, Rost, and then Pimp, and any of the other bros that I can up there. So, and then the B-17, that's so cool about his grandfather crashing in Germany, not cool, but then also hiking to Switzerland. So, I mean, dude, I mean, that's a movie unto itself, you know what I'm saying? So,
absolutely.
That is so cool. But if you think back to the, I think that was the third most built or produced, I should say, bomber back then. You know, I think it was the B-24 and the Junkers JU-88 and then the B-17 Flying Fortress. So, because remember, the 8th Air Force had it out of the England, right? And then the 15th Air Force had it out of Italy. And I think that we dropped about, or the Allies dropped about 1.3 million tons of bombs on Germany, and the Flying Fortress was responsible for dropping 43% of that.
Wow.
So pretty crazy. And not only was it a bomber, it was a drone controller, a transport, and a submarine warfare platform, as well as a search and rescue platform. So it had a lot of different missions. And boy, did it get the job done, you know. So, and then, of course, there's the movie, right, The Memphis Belle, about the B-17. And to my knowledge, I think there are about 10 that are still airworthy in the U.S. So anyway, that'd be great. I would absolutely love to do a B-17 interview one of these days.
Well, and on that note, Sunshine, we have a museum of aviation somewhere in the Atlanta suburb area, I'm told, who has invited us to come out, and they have one that's flying, to your point, in air shows. And so if we can't get Griffin's great-grandfather, which I'm presuming, although he didn't say so, could be by gone by now. I don't know how else to say that gently. sorry about that. Then
departed the pattern.
Yeah. That's right. We'll have to get those who are around. But hey, you know what? Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, Sunshine. I wasn't very brave at 13 years old. Good on you, Griffin, for calling in that question.
Dude, that's epic. Yeah, I was quite the introvert at 13, so good on him.
You still are. No, I'm kidding. All right, let's go to the next one.
Hey, Jello, this is Ben from Atlanta, Georgia. Listen, I had a Top Gun themed question in the spirit of the 50th anniversary just having happened. Read your fantastic article you wrote about reflecting on the 50th anniversary of the school. Really enjoyed it. My question pertains to the career track and how it relates to how aviators get selected to go to Top Gun and what they do afterwards. It seems like just reading the history of a lot of folks who went through in the 70s and 80s that there were quite a few guys who went to Top Gun that did not end up becoming Top Gun instructors or instructors at weapons schools, that just maybe went back to their squadron, did a tour as a training officer or what have you. And then, you know, a lot of them went on to do other things, including quite a few of them going to test pilot school. From my understanding now, it seems like a lot of the folks who are in the community now sort of have to choose between whether or not they want to go to Top Gun and, you know, be an instructor, or they want to go the TPS route. So anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how that's changed over the years. And also just want to say thanks to you and Sunshine and the rest of the crew at the podcast. I really, really enjoy listening to all the content you guys put out, and I'm looking forward to many more great podcasts in the future. Take care and have an awesome weekend, guys. Thank you.
All right, Ben, great question. So a multi-part question. Let's see if I remember everything you asked here. So the first thing is, Top Gun itself changed over the years. When it first came out, it was called the Power Projection Course. And to your point, and to the point of the movie Top Gun, what happened was Pilot and Rio were selected from a squadron, usually towards the, you know, second half of their time in the squadron, to come attend Top Gun. And then they went back to their very same squadron. So they just went away on temporary duty, let's call it. And then when they came back, they were the newly anointed knights of the air, and they would share their knowledge with everybody else. Now, of course, that's a story unto itself, because not every skipper or other pilot in the squadron wanted to hear all that, but times have definitely changed. Now it's different. And oh yeah, so to that point, when they left that JO tour that they were there for, they could go on and do other things, whether it was instruct at the FRS or go to TPS or whatever. Now, these days, you don't go during your first tour. You go at the end of your first tour. Mm-hmm. And then once you go to Top Gun, that dictates where you go after that. And so there are a handful out in the VX community, Sunshine. You probably saw some there with you out in China Lake.
I did.
Yep. And then some go to the VFA FRSs. Some stay at the Top Gun and the other commands, if you will, or departments within Nautic, as they call it now. And then some go to the satellites, if you will, which are the weapon schools on each coast. So it's a different story now. I don't know of too many who went these days to Top Gun and TPS. Do you know any, Sunshine?
I just know two, call sign Lamb Chop. I believe it was Little Angry Man Boy Can't Hack Our Program. Obviously, though, Lamb Chop could hack the program, both because he was duly anointed, if you will. He's got the Top Gun and the TPS patches, and he's doing actually very well in the Navy still. So, and then the other guy was Sausage, last name Dean. So no real, you know, clever acronym there. Right. But anyway, Marine type. Another great American, and he did both Top Gun and TPS.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think we have time for one more question, Sunshine. You want to take this one?
You betcha.
Hey, Jello, how's it going, man? My name's Mason Hilua, calling from Riverside, California. I'm not going to lie, I partied with my friends a little while ago, pretty drunk right now, and I've got fighter pilots on the brain, man. You've done something to me, your podcast. So listen to this. Riverside, California, really close to March Air Force Base. Now, the other day, a plane crashed, an F-16, I do believe. Now, it crashed right through the business of some warehouse. Now, because I've listened to your show, I've seen all these planes flying over my house. I'm like, oh, that one's a transport. That one's a tanker. I'm learning something from you. I appreciate it. Back to my question. The pilot, I believed, was a part of NORAD. You'll explain what that is in a second. He bailed out because of hydraulic failure. Now, what are the ramifications of crashing What if it was entirely his fault? What happens? What if it was entirely the plane's fault? What happens? What happens to the business? What happens to the plane? Money, politics. Give me a little perspective. Love the podcast. Keep it up.
All right, Mason. So thanks for drunk dialing, question mark. But I would ask that you, first off, don't drink a podcast, dude. So,
well,
but thanks for question.
Wait a minute, Sunshine. The listeners have been asking us to do like a drunk history style podcast. So I don't know if Mason's breaking the mold here, you know, anyway, sorry.
Yeah. He might've been the first out of the gate on that one. That's so right. We'll see. Yeah. So I guess back in May and I was up in Alaska, so totally missed this whole thing that happened in SoCal here, but back in mid-May, there was a crash of the 114th Fighter Wing Air National Guard F-16 out of Sioux Falls. He was coming in on the South Flow runway there on March. And they're right next to the highway 215, and there's actually dash cam footage, believe it or not, of a guy heading south. And in the dash cam, you can see off on the left-hand side, which would be the east, you see the ejection, and then you see this plane, unmanned now, so almost a drone, right, waffling across, yes, across a crowded highway, and it crashes into a Seawater Incorporated warehouse. It burrows right into a warehouse ceiling. So I guess they said they had hide failure. So anyway, looking at that, there's a couple of things that happen as soon as kind of switches that are flipped as soon as there's a crash, right? So you got the JAGMAN, which is for the Navy. Anyway, I'll talk about the Navy procedures. You got the Judge Advocate General Manual. So it's the lawyers. They come out and they're going to look at what happened and establish culpability. But then we'll call those, and I love my JAG, local JAG, but we're going to call those the guys in the black hats. Now, you also have the guys in the white hats, right? Jealous, you're looking at your aviation mishap board.
Hold on. I got to interrupt you. So are we talking like old day cowboy movies where the bad guy was in a black hat and the good guy was in a white hat?
Oh, maybe I shouldn't use that reference. Yeah, the JAGMAN's going to come out. The lawyers will come out and try to establish culpability. And then the a parallel effort, but they shouldn't be talking to each other. Stay on separate sides of the fence. You've got the Aviation Mishap Board, and they're going to try to figure out what went wrong so that there are some lessons learned. And then from there, hopefully subsequent pilots or other pilots will take those lessons on board and not do the same thing. So there's two investigations, a legal one and then a safety one, right? So that'll play out. And then based on what the AMB finds and what the JAGMAN finds, the pilot could, at least in the Navy, he's going to go through a FENAB or a Field Naval Aviation Evaluation Board, which is some of his seniors, right, are going to basically judge him. And they're going to say, hey, you get to keep your wings, or hey, you get to keep your wings and not fly, or you don't keep your wings at all. So there's kind of three consequences, if you will, or outcomes, excuse me. One thing, though, when we talk about culpability and all that stuff, there's something back from, I think it was from the 50s, called the Ferris Doctrine. And it's a law that prohibits basically active duty military personnel and their families to sue the government for negligence. So if a plane crashes and somebody, a military service member, dies in that plane crash, his dependents can't actually sue the United States government. So, and that's just an extension from an English common law concept called sovereign immunity. Ah. So anyway, so the military can't sue the government, but the military and let's say the survivors, there's what word I was looking for, they can actually sue contractors if there's negligence found there.
Okay.
So I guess if you think, Jello, back to, it was December of 2008, VMFAT, so the training squadron here in San Diego, 101, I should say, excuse me, had that crash into that house. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and they killed four people. The plane ended up, so the pilot ejected, and then the unmanned plane flew into a house and caught another subsequent or adjacent house on fire, killed a wife, two daughters, and a mother-in-law. And I guess the surviving husband sued the government because he's a civilian, for $56 million. And after the court case was heard and ruled upon, he got $17.8 million. So there is precedence for civilians suing the government for loss, you know, but not military members.
Well, and to Mason's point, I don't think that the owners of the warehouse have to wait to sue. I believe the military shows up and says, okay, here's what you've lost, almost like an insurance claim, and they're going to make an offer. But yes, to your point, in that case, this gentleman lost his whole family. That's got to be devastating. Let's not even start thinking about that. But, you know, that there's obviously a lot more to that. But the company that owned the warehouse and then the tenant inside, I'm sure they were compensated by the legal folks of the military. Yeah, very good. Absolutely. Whoa, that was thorough, dude. That's almost like its own podcast. All right. Excellent. Well, hey, we've got a couple more, but let's save those for another time since we're getting caught up anyway. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
And what do you say we get headed towards the interview here?
Dude, let's dive in. All right. I'm excited.
So before we do, though, I want to tell everybody, to me, Tiger and Fingers sound a little bit the same. So what I've done is I, for those of you listening on headphones or maybe in your car, I've moved Tiger a little bit into your left ear and I moved Fingers a little bit into your right and I'm in the middle. And so you might use that as help for who's speaking at the time. Otherwise, I think it'll be clear and it's just a great discussion anyway. So let's jump to it.
Awesome.
All right. Today on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we are talking about the F-4 Phantom II. And to help me do that, I have two gentlemen in studio with me who both flew it. Did you guys ever fly together, by the way?
Nope. Never did. No. We're always in different squadrons.
Oh, too bad. Well, we'll get to that.
Top Gun, just briefly, but yeah, but we didn't fly together there either. Nope.
All right. Well, I need to introduce both of you so that the listener can hear your voice and get to know you. And we will start with you, John Kerr, a retired Rear Admiral, United States Navy Reserve, call sign Tiger, but also known as John Ed.
Hello.
welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
The John Ed comes from a college thing, but and it kind of stuck with me because I was in ROTC at Princeton, and we had three guys in the ROTC unit that all came to Miramar about the same time, and that's how the John Ed thing came along.
All right.
But
go ahead.
After pre-flight, I went to Miramar. My first squadron was VF-114.
Okay.
A couple of cruises there, and then to Top Gun after that. And then I transitioned to the reserves and spent about 35 years in the Navy between active and reserve time. A lot of good time, a lot of fun. After that, or during that time, I was also with Delta, so I spent 30 years with Delta flying. And I'm still flying today.
No kidding.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. Well, also on microphone with us is retired U.S. Navy Captain Jack Ench, call sign Fingers. Hello, sir.
How you doing, Joel?
I'm great. And thanks for making this happen. Now, you and I have been working on this for months.
Yeah, I know. You're persistent.
Well, I knew the listener would enjoy hearing about the F-4 Phantom II. And I also knew that it'd be great to have a crew. Now, John Ed, you were a pilot.
Yes.
And Jack, you were a Rio.
Rio.
Okay. Right. Well, give us your quick background, if you would. Where have you been and what are you doing now?
Born and raised Springfield, Illinois. Went to Illinois State University.
Okay.
And got interested in the Navy when I was getting ready to graduate and saw some young pilots in their gold wings and in the student union recruiting guys to come in. So I, my wife and I just, we got married while we were still in school. And I said, hey, Juan, that'd be fun to go in 4 years. Wouldn't that be fun, you know, get out of the cornfields of Illinois and see a little bit of the country and the world, you know? And she agreed that that might be a good idea. So I joined up and spent 30-some years and a little over 30 years, as what's the saying goes, and the rest is history. So,
come on. You're going to need to give us a little more detail than that. So you started off in training, in the F-4.
I went through AOCS and then pre-flight down in Pensacola. And I originally came in as was recruited as a pilot, but I was 26. And after I'd finished, got my commission, they said, oh, guess what? Year two would be a pilot.
Oh.
This is 1965.
All right.
So, you know, so bait and switch.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, I'll be a Rio, and I'll go into F-4s, which I did. And came out to Miramar, just like John. And I had two combat cruises in F-4s on Coral Sea and Ranger and VF-21. And then after shore duty, came back and had two more cruises in Vietnam and F-4Bs. That's all I ever was in, F-4B squadron.
Okay.
And that was in VF-161 off Midway, two cruises Midway, second one of which I did not finish. 285 missions, then I took unaccompanied shore duty in Vietnam.
We'll get to that. All right.
But after that, I went on various other things, had my own F-14 squadron and Naval Air Station Key West, and retired as the commander of Naval Training Center here in San Diego.
Wow.
And that was my Navy career.
And now the Midway is a museum here in San Diego.
Yes,
I mean, I'm not trying to say anything here, Jack, but that...
Well, it's... I'll be 82 in November.
Okay.
So I'm just waiting for them to stuff me and put me on display.
Well, you don't look a day over 81. I mean, you're looking pretty good. Okay, I'm not supposed to be funny.
Yeah, I'm not 82 yet, but every airplane I've ever flown and every ship I've ever been on has either been decommissioned or on a pedestal somewhere at a museum.
Yeah, me too.
All right. And did you do some time also, John Ed, in Vietnam?
I did. I had two tours in Vietnam in VF-114. Okay. And that was a squadron that Jack was a skipper of a few years later.
Okay.
Yeah. I had VF-114 flying F-14s. In the early 80s.
Oh, wow.
So that was
okay.
Fighting aardvarks. Once an aardvark, always an aardvark.
Very good.
That's right.
Well, in this very studio, we had a crew come talk to us about the F-14 Tomcat in all its flavors a couple months ago. I don't remember what episode it was, but not important. It was a very successful episode, and I assume this one will be as well. So appreciate you gentlemen taking the time out of your afternoon, and let's talk about the F-4 Phantom. So first off, usually what we talk about on the show is what was it designed to do? Now, I hate to say it, but Wikipedia has become a resource for me, and you never know if you can trust it or not. But it sounds like, to me, McDonnell Design at the time said, hey, we think the Navy's going to need a new fighter. And through many derivations and iterations, they ended up with what now looks to be and is known as the F-4. But I think at one time it was going to be more of a fighter bomber, and then it was going to be an interceptor, and now, or at least when it was operational, it was kind of both. Does that sound true? And by the way, the questions will just be to whoever wants to jump in on this. So,
well, I think McDonnell Douglas had been building airplanes, for the Navy for a while, and they had an idea that I think was filling a gap, and that was the long range intercept mission. But what the design resulted in was not only a fighter that could do the air-to-air mission and do the long-range mission in that they had a Sparrow missile, not a Phoenix-length missile. But they could also carry bombs, and it was a pretty effective bomber. And a lot of the bombs that were dropped in Vietnam were mostly by the attack community in the Navy, but there's a tremendous number of fighter missions flown by F-4s, both Air Force and Navy, that were bombers.
Okay.
Yeah, because originally, my understanding was that McDonnell was going to develop a fighter. Mm-hmm. But the Navy decided that the F-8 and the F-9F Tiger, that would serve their purposes as a fighter. So after many iterations, they finally went to McDonnell and said, okay, what we want is a long-range interceptor for fleet defense.
Right.
And that's what finally came out to be the F-4. Because you got to remember that, we're talking to the late 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. It came into the service, in 60, I think?
I think it entered in 60, that's right.
And so that was in the Cold War when the Russian bombers and Badgers and everything were overflying the fleet and all that stuff. So that's what came out of the, what's the old thing about a camel is a horse that was designed by committee? Well, that's what the Phantom came out to be.
Okay. Well, and because of that role then, and we can skip ahead here to some of the why does it look the way it looks kind of thing, one of the features of the early Phantoms, at least, was that it was designed without an internal gun.
That's right.
And the idea being that they felt that this would be able to do everything at arm's reach, or arm's length, I guess.
Well, it's, it's shortly after the Korean War and the jet age, and the reasoning then was, of course, we always fight last year's war. We never look ahead, I don't think, that the age of the dogfight was over with. And that with the long-range missiles, you would be able to stand off and you wouldn't be engaged. So I think that and probably the weight consideration for the Navy, because coming aboard a ship, if we don't really need the gun, why put it in there? So that's my thought on it anyway, John.
Okay.
Two things, I think. This is opinion. I think the gun is an asset in some areas. I think in a fighter, especially the F-4, it was more of a detriment than an asset because the F-4E, for instance, the Air Force airplane, has a gun. But when you put all that weight in the nose, you really reduce its ability to pitch the airplane and fight the airplane well.
Yeah.
And I flew F-4, I flew all of them just about. But in the end, the best F-4 I ever flew was the F-4S, and it had maneuver slats and a very light nose because it didn't have a gun up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the kill ratio in Vietnam with guns is minute. We had a handful of gun kills in Vietnam, none in the Air Force, none in the by the F-4 in the Navy, and I think three or four maybe with the F-8s, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take that back. SPAD had a gun kill.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
A-1.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Good.
Yeah, that's right. Mostly, there were missiles.
That's right.
And very few Sparrows.
Very few.
Right.
It was
unlike the Air Force, which had a lot of Sparrow kills.
Yes, we did have some trouble with that. But correct me if I'm wrong, part of the reason that Top Gun exists is because of the initial troubles we had both with dogfighting and some of the Sparrow performance and people shooting out of the right zones for the even the Sidewinder to work. And lo and behold, Dan Pedersen gets the nod to start the school and fingers you. And in fact, Jonah, you were there too, right?
Yeah, I was.
A few weeks ago, we all met for the 50th anniversary. So I guess you can look at things as being a detriment, but sometimes it's for the greater good in the long term.
Well, that's true, because with this idea that the air of the dogfight's over with, the training, actual air-to-air combat training, just dried up. They did away with, what was the old FAGU?
FAGU, yeah.
Oh, Fleet Air Gunnery Unit?
Yeah.
That's right. It was like
that
out in El Centro.
So, and so when the hot war starts again in Vietnam, we've got a whole generation of naval aviators that have grown up without that dogfight
skill set.
Skill set. And we're flying out, shooting out of range, out of envelope, and all kinds of stuff as far as that. So that's what happened when Frank Ault, who was the first skipper of my first carrier, USS Coral Sea.
Okay.
What a guy.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to D&L Components Incorporated. D&L Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. D&L Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com.
Wow.
All right. Well, we should have an episode on that sometime. So if my records show correctly here, about 5,000, almost 200 Phantoms built over the years, served from 1960 to about 1996 or so. I think there's still some countries flying them. We'll get to that in a moment. And at one point I have written here, the Air Force, so it was a Navy aircraft initially.
That's right.
And then everyone loved it so much, the Air Force ended up flying it, as did the Marine Corps. And the Air Force called it the F-110 Spectre for a little bit. And
yeah,
I think that was quickly dropped.
Yeah.
But that's interesting because then the F-111 is pretty well known, but I'd never heard of the F-110.
I think that the Air Force, is my opinion, they tried to name it something else because it stuck in their craw that they were flying a Navy-developed airplane.
Uh-huh. Well, to that point, the aircraft that they flew could land on a carrier. In other words, it wasn't different landing gear, right? It had a tail hook. It was an F-4.
Yeah.
And they probably had some consternation with the amount of maintenance involved in some of those more complex and heavy components, but it was cheaper, presumably, to have one variant with a landing gear than to mix it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, we talked about it being an interceptor, but also a fighter-bomber. What did it do well, in your opinions?
I think it did well because it did everything. It was a photo version the Marines flew.
Mm-hmm.
It was a strike fighter, not in the sense that the F-18 is today,
right.
but pretty close in that it carried a lot of bombs. It carried ordnance, and the missions that we flew, about half of them were either bombing missions or flak suppression missions, and the other half were some kind of a pure fighter or fighter sweep mission.
Yeah.
And I think that's what its strength has been, always has been, is versatility.
Right.
And oftentimes it was both on the same mission.
Yeah.
Right.
Between flak suppression or bomb, pull off and then stay in the target area as a fighter. You just, you know, put the switches differently and you're still carrying missiles. So it could do both missions on the same same time.
In fact, I think Duke and Willie D were doing a flak suppression when they shot down their 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
I don't know.
I had them on the show and we talked about it. Lots happened since then. So
could be.
Anyway.
But,
all right. Great. Well, let's talk through the variants. Now, you gentlemen, being Navy background, are probably familiar with the Navy ones. What did the Navy fly? Let's start with those. I mean, we've got almost A through Z on this thing, but what did the Navy have?
The only thing I ever flew was F-4B combat, because both squadrons that I was in were B models.
Okay, and that was the initial variant, as I understand, about 650 of those made?
The
that was like a prototype.
The F-4A was a prototype,
right.
And then they were used in a training, but the yeah, that was the first
operational
one was the F-4B.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about you, John A?
I flew the Bs and then later the Ns, but my first fleet squadron was an F-4Js. The squadron had come back from Vietnam flying Bs and they transitioned to the J model. We had brand new airplanes. It was a great time to be in the squadron.
Well,
because
we
were getting brand new airplanes from McDonnell Douglas. We still had about 10 F-4Bs on the, you know, on the flight line, so we had 20-some airplanes.
Still smelled good, huh?
The new ones did. The old ones not so much.
Yeah.
The F-4J was a great airplane, and then they modified it to the S model. I flew the S model at the end, and to me, that was by far and away the best F-4 right. ever built.
Okay.
Wonderful airplane.
And was there one of those models where they made, finally, the smokeless engines?
There are some Ns that had smokeless engines.
Mm. Okay.
I'm not sure if all of them did, but the S was the first truly smokeless engine, and it had an AUG-10 Alpha radar and an upgraded AUG-10 digitized radar from the J.
Yeah.
So it was a better radar. It had maneuver slats, so it was a better turning airplane.
Oh.
And it had smokeless engines.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the highest thrust F-4 engines they've ever made.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, they were about 17,000 pounds.
18,9.
Is it?
Yeah.
Per engine?
Per engine.
In full afterburner?
Yeah.
So that's what the F-18 with the enhanced engines, the 402s, had in full afterburner.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Now, I forgot to ask, how many hours did you end up with in the aircraft?
I ended up with a little over 3,000 in the F-4.
Oh, wow. How about you, Finish? I didn't warn you. I was going to ask you this.
I don't know. It was over
something
2,000
with some zeros?
Or some. Okay. 2,000
All right.
and something. I don't know.
Okay.
Change. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, so let's rattle through a few more of these. So, like you said, the B was the initial operational variant used by both the Navy and the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
I think. And then the C was the first Air Force version.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, they used to paint theirs different, right? Were they the olive green and we were more of the white, at least back in Vietnam?
Well, we were the, you know, the gray.
Yeah.
But more of a brighter gray than they do now, or was it the...
It was like, a gunmetal gray.
Gunmetal gray.
But they also had squadron, you know, colors on the airplanes back then. They didn't go to full camouflage or the shaded grays until much later.
Okay.
After Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
The B was, its radar was the APQ-72, which was just a pulse radar. And it was designed for intercept over sea. And it was terrible over land. It was all the ground return, everything like that.
Oh,
so
gosh.
It was not. And also, one of the things they incorporated in the B was a... IR detector right under the chin of the it was supposed to be pick up IR, which never worked, and it was just, you know,
extra
so
weight,
it's an easy
extra
way
drag
to tell being a J, because when they bring out the J, they got rid of that damn
IR
thing.
Oh, so instead of adding something later, they removed
it. They took it off, yeah.
Okay.
They took off something that didn't work.
Yeah.
Well, they added something similar back on the F-14, I guess. Well, that was the TCS, but anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So then they had a Wild Weasel variant, the EF-4C, but they later called that just the F-4C, apparently. And the Wild Weasel being the SEED mission, right? So suppression of enemy air defenses. Did you guys ever do that? Did the Navy have a variant of that?
No.
We didn't have that variant, but that was the A-7s were the primary mission for the A-7s, not the primary mission. One of their missions the A-7s. Was
All right. Yeah. Fair enough. And then we had an F-4D, which was apparently an upgraded C model with the AIM-4 Falcon, which was, I guess, a giant missile for non-maneuvering bombers. I'm guessing there wasn't much of that employment.
It was worthless.
Okay. And then the E model, according to my notes, was the first one with the internal M61.
True.
But to your point earlier, Tiger, you know, we've said on this show before, an aircraft, like so many things in life, is a series of compromises. And so you add a gun and you have the benefit of that very close-in weapon, but you pay a price, and that is with weight and maneuverability.
In my opinion, my humble opinion, I think you pay a big price for that,
yeah.
Especially with the F-4.
Where did they mount it, actually, let me ask you?
Under the nose. I'm not sure where the magazine was, but it came out underneath the nose.
Right.
So the gun is well forward, far forward.
Yeah. As it is with the F-18, but the F-16 has it, the bullets actually leave the barrels behind where the pilot's sitting in the wing root, so they got a little smarter on that. So anyway, all right, so then they had the F-4E EJ for Japan, who flew it for a number of years.
They just retired it.
Did they?
Yeah.
Okay. Then the F-4F was for Germany, but that was an E model, basically. And then the F-4E turned in the F-4G for the Wild Weasel mission again. The Royal Navy flew it, apparently, the F-4K. And then the Royal Air Force flew it with the F-4M. And then we talked about the N and the S. And then there's one called the QF-4. Ever heard of one of those?
Yep.
What do they do with those, Fingers?
They're a drone. They shoot them down.
I got to tour the line at Mojave where they were making F-4Es into QF-4s.
Oh, wow.
And there's a fellow up there that was flying the airplanes to Holloman Air Force Base to drop them off to be shot down. Mm. And he, wherever he had stopped, he'd walk into base ops and said, "I'm flying an F-4. And they'd laugh at him. He said, "No, they don't exist anymore." And he said, "Well, it's out there on the flight line. You can go see it." But yeah, they stopped making the QF-4s a number of years ago. I know they're drone the F-16 now, so right. I don't know if that's a replacement for the QF-4 or not.
Presumably, yes. And the interesting thing with that is it wasn't like a one-way door. In other words, you could still fly, as I understand, a QF-4.
Yeah.
In fact, I believe the last mishap in an F-4 in the Navy, do you remember this, was at the Point Mugu Air Show. It was a reserve pilot. He was flying a QF-4, and I don't know if he hot-dogged or did something wrong, but at any rate, unfortunately, he crashed and I think was killed at an air show.
One of the F-4s on display at the USS Midway Museum was in that Q program up at Mugu, and the Navy ran out of money for it, and so they had four or five of them left, and they were taking the wings off and trucking them over to Davis-Monthan. And when we were developing the display on a Midway, I called the museum in Pensacola and said we need an F-4B because that's the kind that 21 and 161 flew when they got their MiGs, first and last MiGs, off the Midway. And Bob Rasmussen down there told me, he says, "It's a good thing you called." He says, "Because the last of them are up in Mugu, and they're being taken apart and trucked over there." So went through the rigmarole of getting it, and they got it approved, and they kept one, and they flew it down here to North Island.
Wow.
And
cool.
And came into North Island where it was going to be repainted and turned into the display. Mm. And that's the last Navy Marine F-4 ever to be airborne.
Wow.
And the crew did a shit hot thing. They came in to North Island and they broke in burner. So, and then it was turned into the display.
That's cool. Well, I'm sure they rattled some windows in Coronado. Hopefully nobody complained too much.
That's
I live
right.
over there and I love the noise, but I know a lot of the residents do not. So, and we still get aircraft coming in and out of there. All right. So that was the QF-4. And then John Ed, you said earlier the RF-4, so a reconnaissance variant.
Right.
And it had a different nose, I think, right?
It had a different nose for all the cameras and it was a fast airplane. Mm. Not unlike the F-8. The RF-8 was a little faster than the fighter F-8, and I think the RF-4 is probably a little bit faster also.
Okay.
Lighter, too.
Nothing like the Vigi, though.
No.
Now, speaking of the F-8, on this podcast some time ago, I'm not sure when this episode will air, but it's recent for when we're recording this, we had a gentleman, Jerry Tucker, you got my note?
You used that word lightly, didn't you?
Gentleman?
Yeah.
He seemed to think that the F-8 was superior to the F-4. Now, he's not here to defend himself, but we could replay some clips if needed. Did you gentlemen ever get a chance to fight the F-8?
Oh, yeah.
I fought the F-8 a lot, both in the F-4 and at Top Gun in an A-4. And it's a great airplane.
It is,
and, and I think they had a spree and a fighter spirit that was unmatched. I'll give them that.
Okay.
Yeah.
However, the airplane was not a match for especially an F-4S and a well-flown F-4S. And the other aspect that if they lost sight, there's one person that didn't have good aft visibility. If they lost sight, they're toast, and they didn't have a chance to regain it because we had two sets of eyes instead of one, and that helped a lot, I think, especially if you ever had somebody over your shoulder that you had to look at.
Right.
And in a multiple plane environment, it's even harder.
Yeah. Right.
To that point, a higher percentage of first sights of MiGs in the Vietnam War were made by the real.
In an F-4?
In an F-4.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Because, you know, like John says, that second set of eyes, especially, we didn't have anything. Once you got in a fight, you didn't have to worry about anything about looking outside.
Right.
Because he had his hands full up front just doing that pilot stuff. But, you know, God love him. You know, you got to love your first airplane. I always, the F-4 is still my favorite airplane.
Yeah.
We'll give Turkey a benefit of the doubt.
All right, fair enough. Hey, let's go off script for a second on that, though, Fingers, because the F-18 and F-16 operationally, single seat mostly. We do have the F-18F, and the Marine Corps has the D. Mm-hmm. But now when you talk about the F-22, the F-35, all single seat going forward. In fact, even in training, they're all single seat.
Oh, yeah.
What are your gentlemen's opinions on that? Because granted, technology's getting good. There's a lot of information available at your fingertips. But I would argue there's still something to be said. I was only operational in a single-seat squadron, but I did fly a little bit with some two-seat squadrons, and I see it. But what do you gentlemen think of only single-seat, theoretically, going forward?
My sense is that there's a lot of advantages for two seats, but with the technology today and the fusion of all the information that you can get inside the cockpit, you have a much better sense of what's going on around you than we ever had in the Phantom days. Yeah. And the Phantom needed two people to run the radar, to run the weapon system, and the pilot to fly. And I think that technology has made great leaps. And I don't know, the F-35 as an example, though, if it ever gets in a dogfight, I think it's going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. One from a maneuverability perspective and from a visual perspective. But
and it's a single engine.
And it's a single engine, but hopefully it'll never get there.
Well, doesn't that remind you, though, of 50 years ago? Yeah. I get this question sometimes on my show is, oh, the F-35 is so good. Do you think this is the end of dogfighting? And, of course, I used to wear light blue also, and I think I'm never going to say that. Look, that's how we got in this mess in the first place.
Well, I got to agree with John about the technology and everything is advanced. I mean, you know, we were in comparatively dark ages compared to what they do today. My first experience with ECM gear was in 66 cruise on Coral Sea.
And that's electronic countermeasures.
Yeah, electronic countermeasures, yeah. And we didn't have any, anything installed in the airplane. We had something they called little ears. You know what that was? Remember that?
I don't.
It was a radar detector with a receiver on the suction cup, which you licked and put on the canopy when you went over the beach. And you had, you're listening to your iPad or something like that.
Earbud.
And we had a trainer in the ready room with all the various frequencies of a fan song when it was tracking, when it locked on, when it shot, and all that stuff. And you were supposed to memorize those and listen to that.
Wow.
Then after that cruise, that's when they started the shoehorn program, where they started retrofitting the AKLs and all that stuff into the airplanes themselves.
Wow.
But that was my first experience. So, okay. I mean, you talk about
Rube Goldberg.
And as far as two seat to one seat, I think, like John said, I think, technology and everything. But with your head, you got to say that. But with the heart, as a Rio, you're driving us out of our job.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, I assume someone smart is making the intelligent, informed decision, but I'm not sure what else to say about
what assume does.
Yes, yeah. I do. So anyway, and I just want to make a comment on the fan song, in case our listener is not aware. That is the radar associated with the SA-2, as we know it, guideline missile, which was, correct me if I'm wrong, the percentage threat. I mean, that was like a flying telephone pole. Yep. You guys feared that, and it brought down a lot of aircraft in Vietnam.
I know it well.
All right. And then just finishing up on the variants, of course, many countries flying the F-4, including some still presently. Let's see, Iran is flying it right now. And I think, did I hear Turkey maybe? I'll have to double back on that and I can put some notes in at the end. But at one time, Australia, Egypt, Germany, Greece, Iran, Israel, Japan, South Korea, Spain, Turkey, the UK, and of course, the US. Mm-hmm. Pretty prolific aircraft.
And the UK, after the Falklands War, the UK had the F-4, and they needed some more. So a fellow at Top Gun, Steve Queen, was one of the pilots that went to Davis-Monthan to take F-4Js out of the inventory at Davis-Monthan and fly them back to UK because they needed airplanes, they needed Phantoms to stand alert in the Falkland Islands after they had retaken the Falklands.
No kidding. Yeah. Wow. Well, this thing has quite the storied history. All right, so we touched a little bit on why
does
it look...
I'd have to say that...
Yes, sir.
The F-4 was probably one of the best weapon systems of bargain that our nation ever bought. I mean, think of all that. The services have used it around the world and everything like that. And what was the cost of a Phantom back in those days? Of course, escalation or anything like that. I think it was $2.5 million was the cost of an airplane. What's the F-35?
Oh, it's over 100, I believe.
$35 million.
No, I think an F-18 was 35. I think it's over 100.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. They're up there. But to your point, a $5 bill used to get you something back then, and it doesn't get you much. That's almost a tip for a guy who opens a door for you these days.
So
anyway, let's not go off on a tangent. All right. On our show and our sister productions before, our co-host Sunshine, who couldn't make it tonight, has talked a little bit about why the F-4 looks the way it does. But for starters, we already talked about two-person, tandem-seated, twin-engine for the carrier. That was, we always thought, the smartest thing to do, and now we seem to be back to single-engine. But also, the wings have an interesting shape, and so do the horizontal stabilizers. And can one of you kindly remind us of why it looks the way it does as far as that goes?
Let the pilot take that.
it's like any aerodynamicist, you have to have compromises. And,
right.
And the airplane, like a lot of airplanes that are built to fly Mach 2 plus, have difficulty slowing down, getting aboard ship, and doing any kind of a hard maneuvering at high angle attack or at low speed. So the wing has a dihedral of about 12 degrees outside of the wing fold.
Right.
Inside the wing fold, it's a standard swept-wing airplane. And it has an anhedral in the tail for the stabilizer to help slow-speed characteristics in pitch for coming aboard the ship. Both features were compromises, I guess, to a certain extent that they figured out in the wind tunnel tests. But it's been effective use of the aerodynamics.
Right. And it gives it, I would say, a very distinct look. Like when you drive down the road today, all sedans look the same, right? I mean, you can't tell if it's a Mercedes or BMW or whatever, because I presume the Highway Safety Board requires certain safety features and that drives a certain design. But back then, boy, the F4, it's distinct.
Yeah. And I think that wing design, the dihedral you're talking about too, wasn't that also what resulted in getting the dog teeth on the front of each of the way they needed that also for maneuverability and the high angle attack too.
Right. And is that where the wing fold occurs? Is where the dihedral? Okay.
And the dihedral and the dog tooth all at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. And if I remember from Sunshine's deep dive correctly, the engineer said, well, the whole wing needs a 5-degree dihedral. But some smart person said, well, if we just do the wing tips, we do them at 12. And then the benefit is for the landing gear, for example, they don't have to be quite so long like as on A4, although that's for a different reason. But anyway, like you said, series of compromises, and the design ended up being the way it is. And I think it's a good-looking airplane. I mean,
beautiful airplane.
You bet. All right. Let's talk armament. Now, what could this carry, or is it easier to say what it couldn't carry? Because it seemed to me like it did almost everything.
We talked about versatility earlier, and I think that's its strong suit. And, and the armament that it carried was a reflection of its extreme versatility. I only flew the airplane with Mark 82s and Mark 83s bombs, 500,000-pound bombs.
Right.
And, of course, all the missiles we had were AIM-7s and AIM-9s. But it could carry rock eyes. So I did carry rock eyes. I forgot about
that. That's a cluster munition.
Cluster munition.
Cluster bomb.
But the Air Force carried a bunch of other munitions. The Navy pretty much stuck to with the Phantom, with the Mark 82s and rock eyes as far as air to ground. But in 1972, we were doing some experiments in North Vietnam with the laser-guided bombs. So we were dropping laser-guided bombs in 1972 out of a Phantom with a handheld laser in the back seat, if you can believe that. I had a mission over Vin. We were at 10,000 feet, and the bombing, which happened to be the AAA's training site for North Vietnam, and I was in the airplane at 10,000 feet doing circles while the other guys were rolling in. We were designating, the RO was designating the target with his handheld laser.
That was Little Ears Redux.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, it's amazing the workarounds, and to a degree, there's still some of that today, I would say, but handheld, well, that's impressive. I mean, did it have like a giant battery, or did you plug it into the aircraft, or what did you do?
I think it plugged into the aircraft. We had to wear special glasses, too.
Right, because of the side lobes and whatever. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, the Phantom was, I mean, my God, we talked about what it could carry. Mm-hmm. It could carry a bigger payload than a B-17
that's right.
Flying Fortress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, almost twice as much, I think.
Employ it more accurately.
Yeah.
The Marines carried a lot because they were ground-based and they had very short missions.
Right.
They go off with a lot of bombs. I ever carried was 12 Mark 82s.
Wow. So I think that's
on Tur's outboard.
That's as much
but
as
then
I
then you had to carry, you had to put a Sparrow
right.
to offset, Sparrow forward to offset the CG.
Yeah.
And a Tur is a triple ejector rack, right? So it's like an adapter to put more than one on one spot.
So you carry six on each wing station.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the difference for the Marines, if they're shore-based, is they can come back and land, theoretically, if they don't employ. But when you are coming back to the ship, you have to be a certain weight, and it's either bombs or fuel.
Correct.
And that is a compromise for sure.
No, we never brought any bombs back.
No, not then. Well, in my career, most of what I did was patrolling, so usually I brought it back. All right. Let's see. How about rockets? Were rockets involved at all?
We carried 2.75 rockets.
Rockets, yeah.
Yeah, sir.
But yeah. I don't – we fired much. Zunis. We carried Zunis in training. I don't ever remember carrying a Zuni on a combat mission.
I don't think so either. I don't remember any Zunis.
Huh? Okay. Fair enough. And then for other missiles, of course, when other countries bought or obtained the F-4, then they could adapt their own weapons. So I read that the UK adapted the Sky Flash. I think Greece had the Iris T. Japan had the AAM-3, and Israel had the Python 3. So, of course, and that's still happening. I mean, Israel's putting different weapons on their F-16s and F-15s. So, all right, pretty standard. All right, how about performance? Now, what's the highest, fastest, most Gs? What? There's book answers, I realize. And the F-4 set a lot of records when it was brand new. Of course, they do that with every aircraft, even the Streak Eagle, if you remember. They didn't even paint the thing. They just wanted the F-15 to set a bunch of records to justify some whatever. But the F-4 did set a lot of records. I read that one flew as high as 90,000 feet, but that seems hard to believe.
98.
Were you in it?
No.
Okay. But what was your gentleman's personal highest, fastest, most G's?
I never went. I have friends that will be remain nameless that went way over 50,000 feet without a pressure suit. Okay. You're not supposed to do that.
No, that's
the fellow at 98,000 feet was in a pressure suit. But the B was, I think, the fastest of the airplanes because it had the thinnest wing.
Yeah.
Okay. It didn't have the fat tires. And I had a B up to Mach 2.2.
Wow.
That was the fastest I've ever been in any kind of airplane. Much faster than I ever flew the F-14.
So. Do you remember, did you have a ground speed readout or anything?
I don't remember what
okay,
it was.
Yeah. Faster than the F-14, okay.
Yeah, well, I never went above 1.5 in the F-14, I don't think, because there were restrictions in the F-14 later on that greatly restricted its top end speed. It was a fast airplane and a quick to accelerate airplane, especially unloaded. But the F-4 flat out could really fly fast. And fly high, but, you know, flying high was never something that excited me.
So. No.
Mine was the fastest I was ever in. It was in a B, too, and it was a 2.1 Mach. Wow. And just over 50,000 feet, 51, something I think. That's Muggs and I went up in the... and...
sky's pretty dark above you.
You see the roundness and the darkness
of the horizon,
and we said, let's get back down out of this thing. But it was a one-time shot.
Yeah,
but said we did it.
I think I got to 54-ish in an F-18, and same thing. It's like it would keep going. This was a naked right out of the depot lot 21 with the big engines, and it would keep going. But I thought, man, if something happens now, pressurization problem wise, I'm really hosed. So
that's right.
I stopped and came back down, but it was towards the end anyway, and I wanted to set a personal best. How about G's? I think if I remember correctly, about seven or so, but...
Yeah, the seven was normal. Six and a half was routine.
Okay.
It could go at certain weights. It could go to eight without an overstress.
All right.
But back when I was flying and getting ready for Vietnam, we flew them hard.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of high G fights. And they're hard on you. They're hard on your body, too.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it's a sustained high G. And you talked about strengths and weaknesses. I think that's one of the strengths of the Phantom. It had so much thrust that it could sustain a high G turn for a long, long period of time.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Okay. I think most I can remember was probably eight.
Eight Gs?
Eight Gs, something like that is the best I can remember.
Huh. Well, let's talk about strengths and weaknesses, Tiger. So the sustained in that case, what else? I mean, speed is obviously a strength, can be at times. How about the ability to regain energy when you were in a fight? In the F-18, that's a bit of a hindrance. In the F-16, it's definitely an advantage. How about in the F-4? Were you able to regain energy quickly?
Yes, if you could unload. And that's the secret. You got to unload the airplane to get the energy back.
Mm-hmm.
If you start at corner velocity 425 or so, you could sustain it for a very long period of time. But if you got slow, you needed to get it back. If you unload, it would come back very quickly.
Hmm. All right. How about in the cockpit itself? Was that how was it compared to, I mean, I guess you can't compare it to modern aircraft, but was it reasonably easy to do your job in the cockpit front and back, or were there workarounds? I mean,
there were workarounds.
How was the visibility, by the way?
Visibility was pretty good. It wasn't anything like an F-14, but the initially the system was set up, the switch from the heat to the radar, whether you're shooting an IR missile or a radar missile, was a switch down in front of you that had a little tiny, it was like the F-14 comment that was talked about. There are a bunch of switches up there, and they're all the same. Well, the one you really need is when you want to switch from a radar missile to a heat-seeking missile,
that's
the one that's critical. So we've put a little extra extension on that particular switch. And it was, you know, it was a 10-cent extension, but it worked. It was a piece of plastic.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was like a piece of rubber hose, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And later on, the F4S rubber. And all the J all had everything on the stick again.
HOTAS, right? Hands on throttle and stick.
Made
okay.
a world of difference. It's so much more user friendly.
So the problem being, if you need to take your hand off the stick or throttle to find a switch, oh, by the way, take your eyes off something, then you are compromising in your maneuvering.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Any other strengths?
I keep coming back to this, but I think the airplane was around for so long and so many were built because of its versatility. And I think that's its greatest strength.
Me too.
Okay. How about bringing it aboard ship? Was it forgiving?
It's a great airplane landing. It's a difficult airplane off the cat.
Yeah.
The F-18, off the cat.
Yeah. I still marvel at the F-18 pilots that take off with both hands. Yeah.
Pete Pettigrew went on about this in our Real Viper episode. Yes.
It's crazy. But the F-4, its center of gravity was close enough to the center of pressure that if you had to rotate the airplane or you're going to go in the water. So you have to rotate. And so the technique was to full aft stick and then a little bit forward. Yeah. And depending on how heavy you were, the little bit more forward you went with the stick.
Wow.
But you had to catch it at the end of the stroke or you were going to over it. I've seen planforms of F4s right off the 60 feet in the air and in full burner just to try to fly away. Because they over-rotated, and that was a common occurrence, I guess.
I've been in a couple of those platforms.
Oh, did they keep flying? Or did...
We've kept flying, but, I mean, it's...
walking on the rudders.
You're walking, the wing walking it up in the air and finally getting up there, but it's a e-ticket ride at Disney World in the back seat.
I can imagine.
Coming aboard, though, on the other end, it was a very, very stable airplane in that regard.
Okay.
And, again, harking back to 1970s, early 70s, we had an ACLS system, automatic carry landing system, in the Phantom, my first cruise in 1971. And it was pretty good. It didn't work all the time, but when it worked, it worked pretty well.
It was built into the J originally, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And then retrofitted to the Bs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Hey, Jello, what a great interview, though. I got to admit, though, dude, I'm kind of saturated at this point. So maybe we should kind of knock it off, if you will, and we'll save it for another day.
Yeah, that sounds good. Boy, it's been a lot of fun so far. And what we'll do is we'll just do a quick normal kind of ending here and we'll pick it back up without a lot of fanfare next time. But let me just remind everyone that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of the hosts and our guests and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. So hang tight with us for a few days, maybe as much as a week, and we'll be right back with part two of the F-4 Phantom II. See ya.
See you then.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.